American businesses need more skilled workers. How do we find the talent? How do we go about developing it? And how do we create opportunities for everyone in our society to get a good job? You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation, a nonprofit media company telling stories about the future of work, the future of education, and closing the job skills gap. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace. We talk with innovators, educators, decision makers, people with ideas and solutions for today's workforce challenges. On today's program, preparing for the jobs crisis ahead. Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, believes that if we aren't preparing for the workforce of the future, then we're preparing to be left behind.
The fact that so many jobs are going begging, people can't fill them, it's ironic. It will actually lead to offshoring. People will have to build plants where the qualified labor is.
I recently sat down with Haass to talk about the future of work, the skills gap, and their impact on our economy.
One of the things I want to talk to you about is we know we have a workforce issue. It's big. Maybe it's slow moving, but it's big. First, why aren't people talking about it? Why isn't it part of the public discussion?
This question of the disappearance of jobs, the need to reskill the labor force, it's all happening as well as foreseeable. It's both present and future. It's also slow moving. In that, it is not unique. It's part of a class of problems I call slow motion crises. I would describe global climate change that way. The deficit and debt are that way. And the problem with slow motion crises is they rarely generate the urgency that is needed for action before it's too late. By the time the urgency appears, most of the good options are long since gone. And that, to me, is the biggest problem here, is that it's happening, it will happen. So that's part of it. The other part of it is there's many other priorities that are crowding out the conversation. And a lot of people, I believe, are incorrectly focusing too much on trade as the culprit, rather than on technology at the culprit. You see that in this administration. You see this, ironically enough, in many of the people who want to become the next administration. And there seems to be a fairly bipartisan unwillingness to face the facts that while trade has played a part in job disappearance, and there have been either some less than ideal trade agreements or simply some situations where imports have displaced American products. By and large, and increasingly, the explanation lies in productivity increases linked to technology. And that gets us back to this question of how we prepare workers for the technologies to come.
And that's an issue that what you were just talking about. How do we prepare for today and for tomorrow? And one of the things that I've looked at often is the BLS's number on how many open jobs there are, over 7 million. And it's been over 7 million for months now. Right. And employers, big and small, are saying they can't find the skilled workers. And combine that with underemployment.
Let's begin with the problem, because we're in violent agreement. Yeah. It's one of the reasons that this focus on unemployment levels is unfortunate. Unemployment levels don't capture the people who stop looking for jobs for whatever reasons.
Or work part-time or have two jobs.
Exactly. For people who are outside, for whatever set of reasons, outside the full-time workforce. So it's the wrong place to look. If we look at the percentage of Americans who are fully employed full-time, it's lower than it was 10 or 15 years ago. You cited the fact that 7 million or so jobs are going begging. Now, one reason might have to do with a more restrictive immigration policy, which is another conversation, but is as self-defeating as anything else of that. Which immigration, high-skilled immigration, is one of the things that made this country as successful as it is. That's perhaps a conversation for another day. But the fact that so many jobs are going begging, people can't fill them, it's ironic. It will actually lead to offshoring. People will have to build plants where the where the the qualified laborers.
Find the skilled workers elsewhere.
So, again, which is ironic, doesn't capture how just how frustrating it is. No, the best answer is obviously reskilling. It also, even if you reskill, just a skill. It also, so it means getting the basic education right for the young people, and it means reskilling for people whose jobs no longer exist or who want to put themselves in a position where they're eligible for the jobs that either do exist or are predictable that will exist in 6 months, a year, 2 years. So this has got to be a massive education and training effort, and we can't feel sanguine or convince ourselves that there's no problem simply because unemployment statistics are low. There's a national comfort level because of that, which
that
is
a headline really, number that doesn't tell the real picture.
It's really misplaced. There's this sense that we don't really have an employment problem. Sorry, we do.
What role do you think our education system does play in this? And are we looking at it wrong? Do we need to like rethink what our structure is?
Well, so much of education in the United States is front-loaded. Education is what you do until the age of 16 or 18 or 22 or maybe 25 if you go for graduate work. But since the average American is now going to live well into his or her 80s, that leads a good 50-plus years after, or 60 years after education ends. Well, it is inconceivable, let me just put that out there, that any education somebody now receives will still be sufficient half a century from now. We'll be lucky if it's sufficient a decade from now. I always call this the filling up with gas model of American education. We fill our intellectual tank up with gas, and somehow we think we're going to drive down the highway of life for the next 50 or 60 years on that tank of gas. It's not going to work that way. That education will very quickly be obsolete or inadequate or both. So we've got to move to a topping off model of education where it becomes much easier. It could be every 5 or 10 years. What are the statistics? If the average person in his or her lifetime are probably going to have, 15 jobs plus or minus?
15, 20, yeah.
15, 20 jobs. Yeah. Well, that might mean 15 or 20 education or training moments. Now, some of those moments could literally be a moment, could be a week, could be a month, could be 6 months or a year.
And who does them, though? Is it the business or is it educators?
Well, the answer is all of the above. It could be the firm could do it where you are if they feel like certain firms are offering training. They say, look, the job you're in, sorry, is going to disappear. But if you're willing, we'll train you for the one that we know is going to happen. Or some other firm would do it. Or you could get it yourself through a community college. You can get it online. You can go back to your school. I think there's any number of options. And in the course of someone's life or career, at various times, they may plug into various mechanisms for getting some extra training or education. In some cases, it may be tied to a specific job. In other cases, it may simply be, hey, I want to put myself in a position where then I can apply for a certain kind of a job. The other thing on the education front, just to complete it, has to be also a better foundational education. It is unrealistic to think that when we're talking about reskilling or life along the way, the highway of life education, that you can compensate for a lack of ability to do critical thinking, some basic reading skills, basic math skills. So we've got to make sure that foundational education is there. And one of the things that I find really somewhere between distressing and depressing is the lack of conversation in our public life about the quality of public education. The only thing we know for sure is that all Americans are required to get an education through the age of 16. Making that as good as it can be ought to be a priority for this society, and it's not. It simply
is not.
There's
no discussion of it. I never hear that talked about either. So the skills gap and that.
It is stunning that here we are in this political year and there's so little conversation about what we need to do to get people to the point where the idea of upward mobility and opportunity are not cliches but are realities. Instead, we're spending all of our time talking about how to redistribute wealth or what have you. The real question ought to be how do we position people so they have a real opportunity, a real chance to acquire some wealth. That, to me, is a much more interesting conversation. And that's where education is the single most important good that we can make available for Americans.
We're speaking with Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. This is Work in Progress, and I'm Ramona Schindelheim. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. The future of work is changing. Are you ready? If you're not yet familiar with Working Nation, let me tell you a little about us. We're a nonprofit media company made up of seasoned journalists, producers, business leaders, and educators. Our mission is to bring awareness to the impact changing technology is having on the workforce. A lot of people are talking about the problem. At Working Nation, we're focused on solutions. We're looking at the programs that are out there, and we're talking to the people who are working to close the skills gap, the gap between the skills employers need in a workforce and the skills workers actually have. We do this through Working Nation videos, articles, live events, and of course, podcasts. All of these and more can be found on our website, workingnation.com, your source for all information on the future of work. Let's get back to my conversation with Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations.
I think another challenge, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, is older workers. I'm a journalist, business journalist, so I know a lot of stats. So one number I saw that was really, really kind of disturbing is when you lose your job in your 40s, it takes 2 to 3 times longer than to find a new job in your than when you were in your 20s, mm-hmm. and usually take less pay because you don't have those skills. Right. There's nobody skilling up those older workers.
You're right to point out the problem, but when you think about someone who's, say, 45 or 50, he or she is probably going to have to work for at least another 15, 20, 25
Absolutely.
Years. The idea of early retirement, Social Security getting us through, no way. So this ought to become a priority. And now there's the added problem of how do you deal with the fact that sometime the salary or wages will be lower? And that's where things like wage insurance can kick in, where if someone is willing to do a certain kind of a job, there could be money to help either transitional assistance or supplementary assistance and so forth. We've got to create a social safety net, which anticipates that the average American is going to go through this kind of a transition a half dozen, a dozen times. Several of those times will be north of the age of 50. And we've got to create safety nets. And it deals with everything from healthcare to paying for the education to dealing with the fact that wages might be reduced. And meanwhile, this person's carrying a mortgage or they're putting a kid through school.
Right. It's hard. And it's hard to go back for training when you're doing that.
Exactly. You're caring for an elderly parent. A lot of these, someone in their 50s is most likely, in many cases, dealing with kids and with parents. So they're sandwiched in that with a set of obligations. So we've got to figure out ways of coming up with a safety net. And again, maybe I'm missing it. Maybe I'm tuning in too closely to the NFL season. But I don't see this being talked about how we are going to come up with public policies at either the state, local, federal level that will help workers deal with a problem or even a crisis, if you like that word, that we know not only is coming, in some cases it's already arrived.
So what are the consequences of not addressing this as a country?
The consequences of not addressing the fact that a lot of jobs are going to disappear and a lot of workers aren't going to have the skill set they require to fill the jobs that do appear, I would think there's a couple of really problematic outcomes. One is for these individuals. Work is very tied to dignity, identity, self-worth. I can't prove it, but I'd bet a lot that some of the opioid problem and other problems we have are linked to this. It can't be good for their ability to be a parent, to be a spouse. So there's the growth in mental illness and the rest, depression. It's going to feed into that. It obviously removes people from the workforce, which is it's a negative twofer. And by that I mean they're not contributing, and at the same time they need to receive. So that's going to be expensive as a society taking care of those people economically. And then I think there's the collective social problem. If we have large-scale unemployment or underemployment, because again, it wouldn't show up necessarily in the statistics, but the reality will be there all the same. I don't think this is a context in which the United States will be prepared to play a large role in the world. I think this will absorb a lot of our bandwidth as a society. It will be, there'll be a sense of, oh my God, we can't afford to do anything out there. Look at all these problems here. And I understand that. But the problem is, if we don't do certain things out there, it'll make the situation here not much worse. These oceans that surround this country are not moats. What happens in the world does and will affect the quality of life here at home, our safety, our security, our prosperity, our health, and so whether I'm talking about the individual or the society or the economy, if we don't get this right, we'll pay individual but also a collective price. You know, we don't think of these things as national security issues, but this is a matter of individual security. It's a matter of economic security, and it's a matter of national security.
We see what happens in other countries when the economy goes south. People, you know, when there's, you know, massive unemployment, and not saying that's going to happen here, but it could.
It could, and you could have prolonged unemployment, particularly in certain parts of the country, certain age cohorts. And again, it's a real threat to social stability. That's where populism comes from. That's where people are willing to make trade-offs. Well, I don't care about democracy. What I really care about is economic security. So yeah, I think it's a threat to not just our economic well-being, but our political well-being. And I'm frustrated by the fact that we're not talking about it in any sustained or even serious way.
We've been speaking with Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm Ramona Schindelheim. Work in Progress is produced by Working Nation, your source on the future of work. You can find out more about what companies, governments, schools, and communities are doing to prepare for the jobs of the future at our website, workingnation.com. To hear more about the future of work and workers, subscribe to Work in Progress wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Annie Chelsea, and executive producers Joan Lynch and Melissa Panzer. Our theme music was composed by Lee Rossevere and licensed under Creative Commons Attribution License 4.0 International. See you next time.